Okay, we will, well, she's chair.
So maybe we won't. Mr. Chair, while we're waiting on the chair of the Student Affairs Committee to rejoin us, a point of information and introduction, as we just discussed, Dr. Capps has created a vacancy, his passing created a vacancy in our parliamentarian position, and we have asked Andrea Anderson, who serves as general counsel of the university, to fill those big shoes. And Andrea has been with us as a tremendous leader, and this really moves us toward what most other institutions in the Commonwealth do, having their general counsel also serve as parliamentary. So I wanted to take just a brief moment and welcome Andrea. She is official, so much to the point that she even has a nameplate. Thank you, Jeff Younglove, for making that happen after I think I made the offer on Wednesday. So that's amazing work. Andrea, anything to share with the group? Surprise, put you on the spot.
Thank you for the opportunity to have shoes to fill.
Happy to have you in that role. All right, with that, we will turn things over to Bridget Henson and the Student Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Chair Bell. We have two information items to go over. The first one is retention and living and learning communities. Dr. Logan, I'll let you take it over.
Thank you, Bridget Henson. Thank you to the board, Dr. Cavoni. This is a part of the master plan of communication. See how we talked about persistence and persistence rates? Now I'll give you the background or the backbone of that in combination. And this is a brief information just to kind of give you an idea of what that looks like and what that means to the institution. I get to speak about it today in terms of student persistence and retention, but it is not a student affairs item. It's an institutional comprehensive expression of all of our work collectively that makes this work. It's not just the work that we do in LLCs. It's also the work that the faculty are doing. It's the academic support, and it's the engagement that culminates in this experience. And so I'm really pleased just to kind of highlight that information for you. This is the institutional research reports that we get on the weeks looking at persistence going forward. And so I wanted to share this with you just to talk about those numbers in total. That's the number which we're talking about in terms of persistence. And if you look at that across this last 4 years, that's the institutional brag point right there, that we have reached a persistence point at 90.9% there for our students who are enrolled in the spring. I'm sorry, who were enrolled in the fall and continued into the spring. The next piece will be the measure of retention. That's the fall to fall number, but this is a piece, the leading indicator of both the success and the engagement of students and the likelihood of their retention going forward. The other comment that was made was if you look at this disaggregated across some of our specific populations of students, we work closely with our underrepresented minority students, first generation and low income. You can see that that was true in terms of how we look at this is a five-year high also for these subgroups of students and the way that they perform. And really, I would really highlight this piece here, 90.3, in terms of what our underrepresented minority students persist in terms of the grand population of students as a whole. That's a fantastic metric in terms of performance by our underrepresented students who have typically, like our first-generation students and low-income students, have had obstacles to their approach to education and have had to overcome more adversity in their experience. And so to see those almost completely even in terms of their persistence and value, that's a wonderful statement. Yes, sir.
Ethan, if I may, one of the things I want to call your attention to, there have been in some public forums concern about the enrollment of students of color at Western Kentucky University. These numbers demonstrate what we've been working toward. Access without success is access to nothing. And we have focused like a laser on making sure we were shaping the incoming class in such a way that every student that we admitted had a reasonable chance of graduating with a degree. And so on the first line under underrepresented minority disaggregated data, I want to take you all the way back to the fall of 2017. In that fall, we admitted 510 students, and then in the spring, we retained, my eyeballs work, 409 or 80.2% of those folks. And so you would say, well, in the fall of 2020,
21, we only admitted 474 students. If you look at the number on the right-hand column, but if you look at the number of underrepresented minority students in the spring, yes, the entering class was about 35 students smaller than in the fall of 2017. But because they persisted at a 90% percentage rate, we had 428 underrepresented minority students, 20 or so more than in the spring of 18. So what we're doing is becoming more efficient with our throughput. That means we can focus more resources on a smaller number of students and create more success. And so I will tell you, closing the persistence and retention gap between our majority students and our underrepresented minority students, that we've closed that to 0.7 percentage point, is unheard of nationally. And that we've managed to do that 10 percentage points during the course of just 4 years also is a national story. This is tremendous performance, and I wanted to call it out and thank everyone who's been involved in this. Dr. Sales, the work that you've done with the ISAC, Pride Center, the work that we've done in housing, residence life, and academic affairs. This is a whole of institution effort to wrap our arms around young people who need some additional help, additional support, to get them across that finish line. But I'm really proud of that effort. It's tremendous.
Thank you, sir. This is similar information. This just provides another variation on the theme of, as we look at separate groups of students, specifically underrepresented minority students, low-income, or first-generation college students. Those are overlapping populations. There are students, obviously, who are both underrepresented and of low income, and could be first generation. So this is a variation of that distribution of students to look at those overlaps and to look at performance there. You can see that those numbers, which are highlighted in that first report, are specific. So you see, if you want out of that, but I will let you take it before I try to draw lines through that pattern. I'm happy to let you digest that for a minute. Any questions or comments on that? This information, and I'm sorry that these numbers are small, and I hope that, and I'm happy to share this information with you separately, but this information here is really to highlight the performance of what we did and what we've seen in our first term of our new LLC program at the institution. Trying to evaluate the impact that has on student life. We have a lot of faith, we had a lot of practice, we had a lot of preparation in terms of what that could be, what that should be, and how we're going to implement learning communities here on campus. And this persistence rate aggregation by students who participated in the program stands to reason that this is a successful venture and we have great opportunity for the growth and development of this program going forward. So if we look at the institutional performance of retention at 90.9%, we broke that down by LLC, so those students who are living in the academic and the themed living learning communities are totaled together. All of those LLCs achieved a 95.4% retention rate, and that's what contributed also to this comprehensive performance of retention across the institution. This work reads not in any LLC. This is the remainder of the institution's enrollment. So that's first year, second year, third year, fourth year. But this is a highlight of what this LLC experience demonstrated in terms of students' performance and engagement in the institutions. That's a great testament to what the program is and what's going to continue to be as we continue to grow and develop and refine this program. So that's a great barometer in terms of what the program looks like. It's a wonderful participation. Yeah,
of course. Yes, sir. First of all, I guess the reason I had no comments about what Dr. Caboni said was to speak for itself. It's pretty impressive. When you look at the learnings, though, what jumped out that we learned and was like, wow, this is an aha moment for us. And how do we build on it?
Well, besides that persistence piece, which is truly, it's demonstrative. The other things that we see were the feedback, the qualitative experiences and feedback that we're getting from the students about their participation, about the creativity and the expansion of what this program is. So this is a wonderful partnership with the academic division in terms of their faculty fellows who are investing in these programs in terms of serving as mentors for these LLCs. And what we're seeing is they're starting to enrich those experiences with students. Our nursing program has got a wonderful example of some work that they've been doing, especially in outreach with the Salvation Army. As a floor, as a pod of the learning community, they're engaged in their curriculum. They're engaged in their learning. But they're also looking at their component of service that is a part of that profession and an expression of that together. They've gone out to the Salvation Army and we're spending time with them. We're seeing the specific groups, new teachers in terms of some of the teaching community, meeting together, I mean, bringing the LLC of the teaching pod together to talk to new teachers, first-year teachers who just got out of the program, just got out of school, talking about their experience firsthand, sharing that time together with food and fellowship, but also learning. And so it's a wonderful extrapolation of what is the pedagogical experience combined with the philosophy of engaged students persist and retain at a greater level. It's a wonderful demonstration.
If I could add, I think some of the other things that were really interesting to me was the interest in students who participated in academic LLCs being engaged in social activities that were separate from their academic work. Meaning, we just want to go to a baseball game together to see the hot rods, or go bowling together, or do the ropes course together. So creating connections and deepening relationships among a group of academically oriented students, but in a social way. So it's really Vince Tinto who really talks about retention in the higher education literature. It's really about academic integration and social integration. If you can nail both of those, your retention rates will continue to go up. First intervention, second intervention in his model. So all of this is grounded theoretically in the higher education literature. We knew it was going to work. Because every place that's done it, it's worked. But at this level, I think we have a lot to be proud of. The other thing to think about when you look at these data is if you look at the students who are not in an LLC and they're coming back at an 86.1% rate, that's in first generation. All of them on the left is 89.4, still close to 90%, but a good 5-6 point difference. There is selection bias. So these individuals who are choosing to be part of an LLC are self-selecting into that program. By the nature of that selection, it says something about those students that might be different than those who don't want to participate in an LLC. So as we combine this, which is programmatically a transformation of the first year experience, and continue to grow it with our marketing efforts and connecting those data that we have on prospective students to the academic experience. And as we have shaped the incoming class with financial aid offerings, particularly above 3.0, no matter your family's income, what you see is a class of entering students that's going to allow us to get to that 80-60 point because it's fundamentally different. The students who are self-selecting into an LLC because of their background and their interest, and if we make that a hallmark of the program, they are more likely to be successful. Not just in year one, but through year four. And so what we have to do is figure out, for the folks who don't self-select in, what do they need? And then how do you get more folks to self-select in because you wrap that around them? And that's next year.
Yes.
Okay.
This is really exciting stuff. I mean, it's an exciting time to be in higher education when you understand what neuroscience is offering now terms of pedagogy and how we learn, and you throw in the Center for Innovative Teaching and Learning, which is a big part of all this, and we're just scratching the surface right now of what we might be able to realize. This is real, it's there for the taking, and you can't do it all at once, but progress where we can and should be.
And I will add this. This goes back to the historic building of higher education, the notion that the Oxford and Cambridge model of university colleges and putting faculty together with students is how you create deep learning and student success. What we're doing is creating a high quality, a tremendous experience for these first year students at a value at WKU of $10,000 a year. You don't even get this kind of engagement in your residence hall at Vanderbilt. You get one faculty head of house to 250 to 300 students. We're talking about one faculty member that has deep engagement and a commitment to those young people, 24 students. That's incredible. And that we're able to do it at this price point, that kind of excellence is a tremendous value. Just something to be so proud of as an institution.
What is our max capacity for the living learning communities? We've got 650 that are in there currently.
I have a housing professional here, I hope, who can take that question for me. Blair?
Our goal has always been to engage as many students that have interest in a living learning community in one of those very important programs. So the answer to your question is infinite. As many students as we can serve, we want to serve. And so it's a matter of taking those LLC experiences and scaling them up so we can serve every incoming student and provide them with this transformational experience.
What's interesting for me is the conversations that we have with students who don't want to be in an LLC. And we had to have some data to be able to engage in this conversation. There are some folks who say, you know what, I just want to come and be anonymous and have a college experience where I can go to class and maybe go to a job, maybe have some parties, and nobody really knows my name. I want to not be known. From my perspective, what we want to do is help convince those young people and their families that actually you do want to be known. And if we're going to admit 3,000 first-year students, if we can get every one of them anchored in some way through an LLC, through a Greek organization, through athletics, through the Honors College, any way we can put a tether on them, we're more likely to be successful. But I would argue, again, that connection between academics and social integrating together is where we're going to get it. And so from my mind, every student should be part of an LLC if we can get there. It's a long on-ramp.
So this partnership with academics and housing, I've talked to a number of faculty who are working with this, and they've all enjoyed it this year, but what I've also heard is there's a different amount of support from some of the faculty, from some of the colleges. Some have more support to do it than others do. And I'm just curious if we're gauging the retention rate amongst faculty as we move forward with this, what their experience is like. And to continue this on, are we going to be recruiting new faculty to go on and keeping these old relationships, or what the thought is there?
Well, Bud, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, if you wanted me to take that one.
I would.
Since it's in this, I would say that the people go, I would think there's about 95% are coming back from what we talked to up to this point. And they are excited, but they have some things that they need to work on. And, you know, you asked a great question, Representative Nichols, because the question they said is they were struggling with deans versus the academic one, and they took a look at that. And what the students and the deans told them was is that they didn't feel as connected because they weren't taking a class in their major. So they asked for a change, and they're going to do that change into the next year so that the students get that better connection. So it's about a 95. And yeah, I've talked with Marco a significant amount about expanding, because I think we need to expand it. I totally agree with the president in that this is a great opportunity for us to create that connection that has to be created. And it's even better connection because I think of it as perfect teaching, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost one-on-one teaching from the time you walk in the door. And Marco and I, so he's out recruiting now, trying to find more faculty to be a part of this. And, you know, we're hoping to get as many as possible as we come into this next year. But they're tweaking stuff daily or hourly in some cases, trying to make the best opportunities and the best experience for the students.
Great. Thank you. I will end it with this. That was a fifth week report, so that was an analysis of where we were with persistence from fifth week, and it chose that specific report, which is, I think, a week old now, because it was at the time of fifth week check-in. And so when we talk about the engagement and the academic combination, that resonance and what it does for LIFT. We also look at how can we continue to expand on our student success. So students who are not persisting at that level fall into our fifth-week check-in program for our students, especially our 100 and 200 level students, where those are classes are asked to provide feedback on students in terms of grades and attendance. And we're purposefully trying to reach out to those students through a variety of means, with academic advising, with faculty and colleges, and with Residence Life staff, to try to make sure that we connect with each one of those students who may be in academic duress at this period of time, while there's still time to try to remedy that situation, support, engagement, attention, tutoring, etc. So the combination of what we set up with the students in the LLCs contributes so much to our success and persistence. But we have to also make sure that we have safety nets to catch those students who are struggling. And we'll work on those to continue to bolster those numbers so we can see the advancement of that going forward. That's the end of that slideshow. Any questions? I am fortunately lucky enough to be the person who gets to present the next group to this austere body, and then I get to get out of the way, because this is, though I am a freelance string player, I am not not one who gets called to New York, and I definitely have a lot of spirit, but I don't know if I can demonstrate it.
Hopefully you meant august instead of austere.
So august, yes, thank you.
That's right, because we're getting ready to have one.
So I feel like just in the meetings I've been in the last month or so, as we were budget meetings and other things and concerns,
yes,
and the strategic priority of admissions and what's going on, and just could you give us, what could you share about how things are going on next year's group?
You bet.
I know it's in process.
I'm happy to. I can always talk about next year's process. I'm sorry, I don't have slides to show you on that. So let me... let me tell you a little bit about our story. What we're seeing in terms of the participation and performance in our enrollment cycle for this fall 22 class, it's very similar to what we saw in 21 in terms of performance. We have better access this year than we did in 21, but it's been later in the cycle. But we're getting there. We're getting more penetration in our market. And what I mean by that is we're having access, one-on-one conversations, getting into high schools and engaging with students and counselors. We have a good reputation with our counselors in our territories. It's just been an access piece that has been district by district in terms of safety considerations and preferences. Where we are in terms of our volume of applications is about, we're sitting at about 90% of what our optimal application pattern was in terms of our volume that we wanted to try to hit. We're sitting at about 86% in terms of those applications of students who were admitted. I've got about 1,000 students in there who are yet to be admitted simply because they're incomplete in the sense that they haven't completed a function of that step for true admission. That's as simple as not just to have an application in, we know that, but they may not have provided a transcript or they may not have paid an application fee. Those are easily remedied. They just are a checklist to continue. So we have a lot of opportunity there, and we're in the third phase of this approach, which is the yield phase of where we are with students, which begins truly in March. March is a transition from application cultivation to the yield process of the admitted student population. So we're really moving into that in terms of aggressively pushing our yield campaign. And that's going to be measured in terms of how we look at performance, participation, and top orientation. It's a factor of orientation, participation, HRL, reservations, and pieces that we can say are demonstrated commitment steps towards enrollment. And we have great support and continuation and engagement and interest from our colleges in terms of supporting that yield campaign. We have a very strong yield program at this institution. We perform above what I consider a national standard in terms of our yield and our melt prevention in terms of where we are. So I feel really comfortable the way that we're going into this period. Our growth opportunity and our enrollment target potential is going to be our orientation cultivation and making sure we get these students engaged, registered, and connected to this institution. The onboarding of the support that the colleges are providing in this conversation is going to enhance that. And I really feel like what we're going to be doing is we're going to have a very strong yield process. But it does take us down to the wire, which makes me very anxious and provokes a lot of need for my blood pressure medicine. But nonetheless, I persist, and I'm very excited about what we're going to be able to do. And it's a wonderful thing. I talk about enrollment management as an art, because if you were to put science on it, you could say it would be quantifiable, and it's elusive in terms of quantifying activity. It's more of a game of spinning plates, and it takes a lot of people working in concert to make it work. The opportunities that we provoke with our communications and marketing is exceptional. We talked about that, and we said this is a professional level. This is the highest standard. I have worked at larger institutions with less capable and less efficient marketing strategies and opportunities. So we work those together, and the engagement that the colleges are in providing in terms of feedback to provide a wonderful choreography of the institution's outreach, followed by moments of interspersed college specific to specific targeted students by discipline, by interest, is going to be a really beautiful system as it evolves. And I have great confidence that we're just going to continue to get better and better about it. So where we are right now, we have a conservative goal of 29,000 students coming in this fall, coming up from our 28 we had last year. And we're on track right now to hit that potential.
2,900 to 900. I mean, 29,000, we'd have a bed problem.
But thank you. It's pretty cool.
Well, just as a follow-up, as y'all might know, I'm on campus, and so a lot of people reach out to me, and they complain about various things at times. And it's always, we don't have enough resources in my area. And I hear that from faculty, department chairs, deans, others. And I try to look at what I consider to be mission critical. And when I look at our strategic plan, I look at the budget process that's ongoing. So much of it falls into your area, the admissions, the retention, the advising, the experience that Dr. Pavone was talking about comes from your staff. And so when I look across the holistic thing of what we're trying to do, we need to make sure that you have the resources you need in order to do your job. And that's the question. Do you have the resources you need to be successful in all of these components?
You bet. I do. I have this institution's support and commitment. Not just in resources, but in partnerships and in support. So, yeah, I think we do.
If I could add on to that, because I'm going to draw a thread for you to other strategic decisions we've made as an institution. And so what you're seeing are tremendous partnerships between and among the provost's office, particularly deans and the five colleges, and recruitment, admissions, and enrollment. But what is that connected to? I mean, Bridget Spill, you're right. Everything we do is enrollment-centric, because that's what drives the largest portion of our budget. But when you have a new budget model that incentivizes college leadership to say, for me to do better, I need to have more students studying what we teach, that creates and deepens the partnership. It creates an urgency, not just from the center or from the president, but it creates an urgency from a dean, because the dean knows, if I want to shift the budget that I have upward, then I have to recruit more students, enroll more students, and then retain more students. And there's a reward for that built into the system that in a different system that's centralized may not exist. So I may get all these new students, but why is that money going over here? And so I think that as we, again, mature in a decentralized budget model, what you're going to see is the relationship between reward structures, doing things that we need to do as an institution, working in concert with each other. And I want to thank the deans. They have been miraculous in what they've done this year. The urgency that they've created, the focus on this has been outstanding, and then the partnership. And so I do want to recognize that effort publicly. It's been just terrific, and the partnership between provost office and enrollment has been great as well.
Truly, truly. That the collegiality of our existence amongst these divisions and the deans is exceptional.
Does anyone have any more questions for Dr. Logan before we...
Can I ask one? And I want to say I appreciate, especially as a communications person, what I've seen in terms of the integration and the plan mapping and the collaborative work with the deans and the new provost, I think it's outstanding. I think that's, for what I know, it's the right approach, right? And I'm glad to hear that you have the resources, because I know that was a push, and we've been looking at that in the back end. But the part that I'm most curious about, just as an information answer, is do you have the staff? I mean, where are you on admissions staff? Do you feel like you have enough people right now to do the work that's needed, and are we able to recruit those people and retain them as employees?
That's a great question, and I think that we are moving in that direction to have both a fulfillment of a solid staff and the ability to recruit those. That's a part of my conversation with the institution to represent enrollment to our budget process this year. Definitely, we've been challenged by competitiveness. This is a very competitive market for especially for counselor outreach because institutions subtly try to one-up each other. And that's okay. You know, the winner is always the student in this process to be enrolled. But of course, we have our particular needs that we would like to see fulfilled as well in terms of enrollment. So we're always trying to find a way to provide nuance that is going to provoke, this is the greatest opportunity for employment. Part of that's competitive, this of compensation, but it's really going to be also a combination of how we provide for those students, those professionals to do their work, and to really provoke the sense of what we can provide in terms of professional development.
And I know that that's a focus of the university moving forward, and we've seen great results of that so far. And I appreciate your time, Dr. Logan.
Thank you, sir.
Now, Matt, you had a question.
I did, yes. I just wanted to, I guess, go off what Regents Fuller just said. And speaking of our engagement with the colleges and the students in those colleges, I know advising is an issue that a lot of my peers have had issues with. Mm-hmm. And so I know that it plays a critical role in ensuring that our retention rates are where they need to be. So what steps are we taking towards ensuring that our students are getting to meet with those faculty members? Because I know a lot of them are overwhelmed, and they don't necessarily get the direction they feel that they need to graduate in 4 years and get to where they need to be.
In terms of advising?
Like responsiveness and okay. Just sitting down with those professors.
Well, that's a wonderful question, Matt, in terms of that engagement with faculty and meeting with students. And I would let the provost respond.
Great toss.
I will tell you two things. We were approached by your group to have a conversation about evaluations, and that conversation went on with the Faculty Senate, which is the group that takes care of evaluations. What would be any type of that evaluations of their people, and they came to a conclusion, and supposedly they told me the other day, because I asked this question, they sent it back to you guys for some comments. So there's where we are with getting evaluations put in. So it's back in your guys' court. Two is the deans have been told to tell their faculty to be more receptive to students and to make sure that they're ready for those evaluation periods, because you have to be. I mean, that's incredibly important. I agree totally with that if you're not, you're going to fail miserably in this. And people need to know where they're going, and people need to know the path that's going to allow them to get to the end. And I will say for this generation, usually as quick as possible in a large number of cases. So that's where we are at this point. Now, I don't know what that model looks like into the future, but right now that's the model we're working on, and that's how we're trying to take care of it.
And if I could go a little bit further about what we should take a look at, right? So sure. If you look at success on our campus, Gordon Ford College of Business has professional advisors not just for years 1 and 2, they continue that in years 3 and 4. And so if you look comparatively at their engagement and retention versus those that have only faculty, not supported by professional advisors, what does that look like? And so I think there is a conversation to be had around if you're relying upon faculty to provide course-taking advice, is that the best use of a faculty member's time, or is it the professional academic advising about what your aspirations are and how do you do better in the classroom? And for the technical course-taking information, so that it is very accurate and gets folks to graduation, is there a way of thinking about the first 2 years of advising being done by professional advisors centrally? But do you have a decentralized model within each college
where juniors and seniors receive that kind of specialized advising by professional staff, and then you layer upon them faculty who give not necessarily course-taking advice, but life advice, professional advice, academic advice. So I think that that will be the conversation that we have in coming years. Did I just set the ground for that?
You knew what I wanted.
I was just going to say, and the career counselors that we have as well.
Because
when we talk to the parents when they come in, they're like, well, what kind of jobs are out there? How do we do this? And we start working that very early on, the importance of that, and having them meet with them. Again, a successful model in the college business.
And I think business, if you think about degree programs that are tightly coupled with professions, you see in the business school, I want to do marketing. Well, I'm going to study marketing, and I'm going to go do marketing. If you think about in the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences, I want to be a teacher. There's someone who helps me work through my accreditation to be a teacher and then connects me directly to a teaching position. Same thing is true in engineering. I have to be certified. I work through this and I move directly into a profession. Where it becomes more difficult are those loosely coupled degree programs, particularly liberal arts and sciences, and some of the softer, less tightly coupled degrees. And so I think we have work to do there as well.
We have a good engagement, though, through ACDC in terms of how we do academic advising in lockstep with career counseling and try to integrate that early in the beginning of the conversation instead of like when I chose to engage career counseling as a senior in my second semester. It's a better opportunity. And so for those situations that are loosely coupled like that, we're trying to get them engaged early to start careers in association with degrees.
I appreciate you answering all the questions as I have these conversations across campus, and we have people leave. Regent Thomas talked about what's going on in industry. People have a lot of opportunities and places to go work now, so we have these vacancies that are occurring, and I'm just trying to look at the mission critical positions we need to get in the field, whether it's in ACDC or other places, and those ones that are working directly with students and leading to those retention rates. Just I want to make sure that we're.
My parents asked me, now, what can you do with a degree in speech and rhetoric? I think my answer was, well, anything.
University president.
But we have to be able to give a more tightly defined answer.
Dr. Logan, are we ready to move to information item number two?
If you'll indulge me in getting our key presenter.
And one of the young ladies.
Yeah, I'm warning you all that one of the cheer squad is an ale pot.
Linda, it's nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. I hope to be there in person. I appreciate your patience and the remote attendance.
Yeah. Well, you look great on the screen.
Okay. I don't want to see what that is. It's like, but thank you all.
Thank you, Regent Henson. This is our Spirit Squad complement of our national champions today that I would like to... I'm really pleased to be the Student Affairs Committee just to introduce this group. I have nothing to do with their program in the sense that they do wonderful things. But I'm very supportive, and we have done some really good things institutionally to help enhance this program. But it's all these folks right here.
If I could add just a bit... Before you introduce Allie, we made a commitment 2 years ago to transform our cheer program. And Olivia will remember the conversation that I had with her about what we were producing and how that represented the institution's brand and how we might think a little differently about that. And we hired a cheer coach who departed us for that blue place up the street a little bit. And I was unhappy because we had spent a great deal of time recruiting this person. I told Olivia and Matt Morrison, you tell her she better find somebody as good, if not better, than she is to come here this fall. And she did. And so we quickly re-recruited a director of our cheer program and Spirit Squad program, and Allie Lumpkin joined us 2 years. This is our second competitive season, about 2 years ago, in the middle of a pandemic, and has really transformed what we're able to create on the field, but also in competition. And you may have noticed, to elevate the brand, an investment in a new set of look, feel,
and talent. And so they are athletes first and foremost, students first and foremost, but these are young people are pure athletes, and I'm proud of what they've produced. I'm proud of what you and Dalton have created and Olivia with your leadership. So with that, Ethan, anything else to add?
Allow me to introduce this group. First of all, Olivia, who's our associate athletic director, who works with our spirit squads, Allie Lumpkin, who's our head coach, our assistant coach, Dalton Stanley, both in their second year here, and then our wonderful students who are with us today. That is Jaden Embry, Andrea Red Lenore, and then two members of our all-girl squad, which is Alessia Lambie and Abby Normal.
You may recognize Abby.
Yeah.
As a homecoming queen.
Yeah. He's also a real pop.
Yeah.
I just got to mention that, Dr.
Well, I just wanted to say, start off by saying thank you so much for having us and welcoming us to this meeting today. It's my honor and privilege to be here, and I can't wait to show you a little bit about our program and let you know the excellent work that's been put into myself and my athletes in order to bring the best to WKU. This year, we brought home our first small co-ed national title. Back in 2021, we brought home all girls' first national title, so a very strong 2 years for both of our programs. We're very excited to see that and the growth. I'll just go ahead and quickly say that we had our first spring clinic of this semester just last weekend, and we had over 140 athletes in the building for that. So that was just unexpected, crazy. We had probably 120 of them that were pre-registered and then just more flowed into the building from there. So we were super excited about all that talent there. I just wanted to start off just to refresh kind of this year what happened at our college nationals. So we work all season long starting in the summer when the team is made in May, and we will have a few practices over the summer working on our game day, and then once we're here for the fall, we start really prepping for our nationals. And we prep all season where we compete in January one time. We get one shot, and if it's good enough, we move on to the final round. So two performances, really. So all of our hard work goes into 5 minutes of performance time there. So you can see some of the scores. In our all-girl D1A division, schools like the University of Alabama, Indiana University, the University of Mississippi, Mississippi State, Florida State, University of Alabama, Birmingham, those are all just a few schools that compete in that division. And you can see how close our all-girl team was right behind the University of Alabama, just a fraction of a point there. But then you can also see between second and third place the big point gap that we had there. So we're right where we need to be, a little bit more polishing, and we're just going to step right over that 91.7 next year. That's the plan. For co-ed, same schools in that D1A division, we've got Florida State, University of Minnesota, Memphis, just a few, Bowling Green State, App State, are all in those divisions, and you can see that our co-ed team absolutely dominated that division, and that was a really cool experience for us all. That was our plan, was to go down there and just really show them that our talent level and our skills and the way that we executed was just so far ahead of everyone else, and I think that we accomplished that this year. We also had, on our first night of competition in Orlando, we had three different partner stunt and group stunt couples that performed and competed. That is just a couple, a female and a male, that go and perform a routine. We had two of those, and then we had an all-girl group as well go out there and perform a set of skills, and all three were able to come into the top five in their respective divisions, and those have anywhere from 10 to 15 different competitors in each of those divisions. So again, something very proud. I don't think that's the first time that WKU had couples represented in partner stunt, but I feel confident in saying that this is the best showing that we've had in those divisions. Just a little bit of kind of what our team is made up of. We've got athletes that represent 12 different states and even one country, well, two countries including the U.S., but Alessia is actually from Canada, so this is her fourth year with us, so she'll be graduating. So it's really nice to see. Really want to start tapping into, you know, the mid part of the United States and then onto the West Coast. So we'll tell you we've got some people interested from Colorado and Texas this year coming to our program, so just expanding upon that. Lots of our athletes are involved in many different organizations throughout campus. You'll see SGA. We've got Greek Life. We even have athletes that represent the MPHC organizations as well, so we're excited about those. We have athletes coming in as transfers from junior colleges and also other major universities coming in and just looking at the experience here at Western, what the cheer program can give them, and then also coming to campus and seeing what WKU is really about. A lot of people that come and visit WKU, their first thought is, wow, it just feels like home. And I think that that is just a really cool thing for athletes, especially coming from out of state and coming from far away. You know, we want them to feel at home here. They're going to spend a lot of time here. They don't get a lot of opportunity to go home throughout the season. So for them to feel at home here, I think, is really important. Just give a little shout out to all of the investment that has been put into this program in the past 2 years since I've been here. The change and the welcoming of a full-time head coaching position has just really emphasized the ability for me to put in the time and the effort into giving these athletes my undivided attention at all times by being able to focus on them every day. I'm checking in on them in school, making sure that they're doing all that they're supposed to, making sure that we're getting involved in the community and on campus as well. Our athletes we introduced a scholarship program for them this past season. This is our first season with that. And all of our athletes are able to have their out-of-state fee waived, which is a huge difference maker. You don't see that in a lot of institutions across the country at all. And then each athlete will get $2,000 per academic year. And again, that's every athlete. And I just think that that's amazing that each athlete can benefit from a scholarship like that. I am confident in saying that this is the best scholarship program in the state of Kentucky as far as schools and universities go. And we are right there with being in all of institutions across the country, being up there with offering the best for our student athletes there. We also have 4 premier scholarships, which covers all of an athlete's tuition costs, which is really nice for us to really be able to kind of invest in some of our leaders that are on the team and really give them a little bit more and gives other athletes a chance to work towards something and to earn something even more in their future with WKU.
Can I add something?
Yes.
I'd like to add something. I want to put a little emphasis on the full-time head coaching position because I've been around the cheer program for a very long time. I've been a part of it when it was really at its lowest. And fortunately, I'm able to be a part of the highest accomplishments that they've had thus far. But I want to explain because she does this. She doesn't give herself enough credit sometimes. But she's the head coach of 2 different programs. She's the head coach of an all-girl program and a co-ed program. That's 60 athletes. 60 athletes. That's right where our baseball team is, or that's above our baseball team in numbers. So she's sitting right below the football program of having the most athletes to be responsible for. And prior to investing in a full-time coaching position, we had 2 part-time people that had other lives. They had another full-time job that actually put food on their table, and this is what was their love. This was their hobby. And, you know, they were able to give these athletes the attention that they deserve on a full experience for college. And so that experience or that investment was a complete game changer. She accomplished 1 national championship in the first year before we even implemented the scholarship program. And that was just because of the time she was able to invest on a full-time basis. So I like to put emphasis on that because she doesn't say that as much, but there's not a lot of other institutions, if they have a co-ed program and an all-girl program, that one coach is running both of those. So I've now experienced competition with them. I'm a football girl. I don't know a lot about cheer, but now I do. And their competition is unreal. Now that I've been able to experience it, she's in the back warming up with 1 group. She's going to another warm-up to another group. And then she's getting in the front for when they compete. Like, she's all over the place, but she says it all the time that I wouldn't want it any other way. But we were just sitting outside, and Alessia was explaining about how her freshman and sophomore year, they were very separate. Co-ed was over here. All-girl was over here. And now when they compete, if one of the other teams is in the audience ready to go, they don't feel comfortable performing. Like, they are one unit, one program. And that's been the biggest growth, I think. And investing in 1 full-time head coach, like, really put that on another level. So I want to explain that because a lot of people don't know because I didn't know either. So I really just want to explain that that's a really big deal when comparing us to other institutions.
Yes. Thank you. This is – let me make sure that this plays correctly. Okay. This is just our crowd video that we submit at the beginning of our competition before we go, and it shows the way that we're involved on campus, the way that we're involved in the community, and the things that we do on the sideline and things, and that is part of our score. So we've put together a few clips, and you'll see the alumni luncheon during homecoming, and this is at the Alzheimer's Walk. And we just, these athletes, the great thing about having so many athletes is the ability to make sure that their presence is felt throughout the community. You know, they're able, with everybody gets the opportunity to go into the community and put their efforts out there and just be involved and find new organizations that ultimately leads them to networking post-college life. You know, they get to put a lot of these things on their resumes for grad school or whatever job opportunity that they're going for after. So I think that that's a really great part. I put a lot of emphasis on that to my athletes, is making sure that when we have these opportunities, you need to be volunteering for them, because you never know where your interest, you know, where your career path is going to lead you, and you never know what could enhance those opportunities for yourself in the future. We love being on the sidelines. I think that we've done a really good job the past couple years. You know, last year was kind of hard because of COVID, and the stands were just so empty, and we were doing our best to be entertaining. You know, that's our job. We're supposed to be there to enhance the game day experience for the fans and for the athletes that are competing there. So this year was really fun to finally get those fans back in the stands, and to really, we're continuing to learn about the game day experience. We've implemented our Big Red Rally, which is at the very beginning of the football games. Right after Topper Walk, we'll go usually outside of the alumni tent, and we put together just a little performance, just something else to get people excited and get people to the game, before the game, and ultimately into the game, because it's fun. We want to be there and want the athletes to feel supported at all of their events. This year, this is our U.S. national team. We have a co-ed team and an all-girl team. I'm actually one of the assistant coaches for the co-ed team. This organization has been around since 2009, and I was a part of the program on the team in 2011, 12, and 14, and then I was asked to be a part of the coaching staff starting in 2015. So what this is cheerleading is trying to be implemented into the Olympic Games. And this past year, it has been accepted as an Olympic sport, which is really exciting for our industry and our sport. It's getting the recognition that that we've all worked so hard to just show how athletic that we are. And this year, we have four members on our all-girl team that are representing WKU on this U.S. national team. And they had tryouts back in the fall, made the team, and now they've had some different training weekends. You just kind of see, this is a little clip that they had going on at their very first training. They train with athletes from universities all over the country. When they go and compete, they will compete against 60 to 75 other countries down in Orlando, Florida, and ultimately go for the gold. That is what, that's what the U.S. cheerleading was born here in the United States, and it is our pride and joy to show the world the best cheerleading in the world. So I'm very excited for these girls. I won't coach them personally when they're there, but I will get to be there and be a part of that with them just on the other side, on the COVID side. So we're super excited about that. Just to kind of end us out, and then we're just going to show you a clip from Nationals. This is our co-ed's winning routine, and then after this is shown, we'll open up the floor for questions, or if you guys have anything you'd like to ask me or any of our other athletes, you'll be more than welcome to. I hope the sound works.
Jeff, you got us on the sound?
You might have to be on the video.
Maybe it's not through Zoom.
Well, it still looks good. So this year, this team is considered small co-ed because we compete with five guys and then the rest are girls. They are increasing the numbers in the division. So last year we competed with 16. This year we competed with 18. And then next year they're moving the numbers up to 20. All girl competes with 20. They always have. So they are increasing the co-ed numbers as well. It is our plan to jump into the large co-ed division very, very soon. I would like to say we will make that jump this next year, but again, we're going to wait for tryouts and make sure that we are prepared, because if we go into a division like that, I want to make sure that we are in contention for a national title. If we choose to make that jump, then we will be competing against our neighbors up the street. I can say that because I cheered for it. So now, you know, red is the new blue. That's what I like to say. So that being the case, when we go large co-ed next year, you'll see 11 males on the floor and 9 females. So it's important that our co-ed program continues to grow. This past year, we had 12 males on the team, period, and then we had about 12 girls as well. So we'll need to see that number increase just a little bit, just to make sure that we have the personnel appropriate to go into that division as well.
Allie, we talk a little bit about, or maybe the athletes talk about the training regimen. This is—it's not just in the gym; it's not just in the practice gym. It's also in the physical gym with weight training, nutrition, but the amount of time this takes.
Good, y'all know, y'all living it right now.
So we have 3 practices a week. We practice on Sunday, Monday, and Thursday. Also, we have 2 workouts a week where we are in the weight room in Diddle with Coach Cal, who has been amazing for our growth. And being a senior, this is my first year that we've had a strength coach, and you can just see the difference that it has made in the program. The strength of the athletes, even preventing injuries with people that were stronger, more flexible, and more capable of doing these skills, and were safe doing them. And then also, in the past, we've had a nutritionist who has talked to us about nutrition and fueling your bodies and making sure we are eating properly and eating enough, because in nationals, we go through 2-day practices where we're practicing in the morning and we're practicing at night, and making sure we're eating enough to get our bodies through that.
So for 2-a-days, that's all through Christmas break. So when they are finished with their finals, they are here until probably the 22nd of December doing 2-a-days every day, sprinkling some basketball games in there. They'll go home. They'll come back the 26th, I think. We start practices again on the 27th and hit full speed ahead between then, and we'll leave for nationals. Typically, it's around Martin Luther King weekend, every weekend in January, so... once we come back from Christmas break, we are still 2-a-days, and then we'll start doing performances there to prepare them for nationals. I think this year they had 36 days of 2-a-days. Yeah, so it was a lot. And, you know, just with the difference in coaching styles from what they've had in the past to now, I know that that was a big shock on their bodies as well. So, yes, huge thanks to Coach Cal for being able to get us through that. But if you guys have any questions, or if you guys want to say anything.
You mentioned strength and nutrition, which are important for prevention of injuries and recovery. The other thing that we know is very important for those things is sleep. Very seriously, injuries are much more common in sleep-deprived people. And recovery from injuries is hindered greatly if you're not getting a good night's sleep.
I think one thing that helps is, since it is over Christmas break, we don't have classes going on. Mm-hmm. So when we're not at practice, we can sleep and eat. So it's kind of just cheer becomes our full-time job. We don't have school in the way.
Is that you all talk about? Allie, you all...
It's certainly not as big of an emphasis that we put on eating and, you know, nutrition and strength and conditioning. But that's certainly focused on, you know, when we're ending our day, we instruct them, you know, this is your time to go home and rest. You know, if you want to socialize with each other, by all means. But, you know, we typically let them out around 8 p.m., 9 p.m., and then we'll start the next day around 10 a.m. So it's not super early. We're not getting them. We're allowing them as much time as we can. And like they said, I think being Christmas break allows for a lot of not having classes helps with that, too.
I think one great thing is also priority registration, so that, like, with classes, if we do a practice, we can, like, schedule our classes in times where if we need, like, a little rest and just to lay in bed and rejuvenate our bodies before practice, after class, we have the ability to do so because we do get to register early.
Yeah.
And all of our practice times, like, that are not in national season are very convenient because they're in the evening or at night. So during the week when we're in the normal semester, we'll practice after 6 p.m. And then on the weekends, we might practice in the afternoon. So we can have, like, a consistent sleep schedule and keep up with jobs and schoolwork and that as well.
Anyone else have any more questions or any comments?
I have a comment. Olivia, you were very nice to say that Allie doesn't say enough about herself. You don't say enough about yourself.
That is true, too. That is true, too.
We talk about staff leadership on campus and collaboration and the effectiveness of rising stars and people that we need to retain. Just like with Travis Hudson as a coach, our staff members like Olivia, who are examples of outstanding leadership. We talk about staff-driven initiatives, and we don't mention athletics enough as a staff-driven initiative. These students are working with staff. These are not faculty-driven things. They're competing. This is about the total university experience. Some have jobs, which you've mentioned, in addition to all of these other activities. So building these complete individuals is driven by people like Olivia and Allie and those people in charge. And I think it's a tremendous effort. You know, you mentioned early on, who mentioned it, 140 kids came to a clinic, right? Essentially a day clinic. I mean, that's 140 touches of potential students, and you reinforced the branding and the positive attitude and our success as homecoming queen, sorority involvement, all these extra extracurricular activities that really complement growth of individuals. And to see those as living examples is just a tremendous thing, and I can't say enough about the work in athletics. We talk, you know, there's some perceptions back and forth sometimes about this and that, but the total body of work that comes out of that area is just so impressive, and I can't say enough about people like Olivia and Allie and all of you all as athletes that are in that area.
I can definitely, like, speak to that, too, and, like, preparation for the future and how, like, it's so, like, awesome to be a part of something that pours into you so much. So this university has poured into me so much. This program has poured into me so much. And just, like, going into the future, just knowing, like, that you're leaving something better than you thought.
Abby is, she doesn't, speaking of someone that doesn't give herself a whole lot of credit, Abby does everything. I mean, everything. She's got so much on her plate, and she has applied to law schools all over the country and is just getting to get accepted to all of them. She's been accepted to UK. She's been accepted to U of L. And she's just waiting on more. She's waiting on more acceptance to make her decision. But yes, having someone like her crowned as homecoming queen, just I think you could see if you look back at all of those pictures and that experience, just how much she is loved by her university and by her program, like cheer, and she truly does deserve all of that. And all of our athletes are just—they do a phenomenal job of being such great people. And not—they're more than so much. They're so much more than just a cheerleader. And so, I'll be their biggest cheerleader. For
Abby, you're also an alumni ambassador.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I'm a student alumni ambassador, so I served as the membership chair of that last year. In terms of my involvement, like with NSGA, I was the scholarship chair my sophomore year. I got to do a couple of great things with that. I revitalized a program called Earn a Computer Program, and so I got to award over 20 free computers to students in need that didn't have access to that technology, especially during COVID. I worked with the surplus office, so it was like free of cost thing. I created the first ISEC scholarship through SGA's. Last year I served as the executive vice president of SGA. I was the Circle of Sisterhood director for Panhellenic and funded a school build in Malawi for underserved children. So I've just served in a lot of different like leadership positions like throughout campus. And it's really like the support system that I've gone through cheer is awesome for that. And as Allie said, just it's prepared me for the future. It's given me a strong mentality. It's taught me discipline. It's taught me how to mesh well with others. So it's like all of these life lessons that I will take into the future. So I went through the application process for law school during nationals. So that was and yeah, I've been accepted to 5 law schools and just waiting to hear back from a couple more. But just leaving knowing that I have all these experiences and all this preparation for the future. My personal statement for law school is actually about being a D1 athlete. and kind of like being for athletes because I want to do sports law. So definitely prepared me for the future and inspired me for that. So
I met her because she was a student alumni ambassador and she attended the sisterhood luncheon that we had back in November. Mm-hmm. And she was seated at my table and we got to talk quite a bit. And then, of course, I found out she's nail pie and welcome queen and other things like that. But it was just a pleasure to get to meet you then. And I've followed you ever since then. But, I mean, cheers to the alumni ambassador program, or the student alumni ambassador program. It's actually quite good, and it was good to meet students that come to our meetings and interact, and it was a pleasure.
That was a fun meeting. Yes, it was.
Let me point out, Al is a graduate, born and reared in Glasgow and Barron County.
Yes.
To piggyback off of like what everyone was saying, most of us here in like the collegiate level of chair have been chairing for a long time. Me personally, I've been chairing since I was in the second grade. I'm a sophomore here on the Hill. And I just want to emphasize I've never been a part of a program as like supportive and rigorous as the one that Ali has created for us. And the support that we get from all over campus, from the athletic department, like Liv, from you all, and from the students here as well. Like when we see people on campus, they'll interact with us, interact with them, the people of the community as well. So it's just nice to have see at the table, I guess, and feel wanted and feel that we are being poured into with support. And with that support, we can give good outcomes for our campus here as well and bring in national titles. And we hope to do more in the future, you know, to build a legacy here. And, you know, red is the new blue.
So with Senior Day being tomorrow at our last home basketball game, I get to recognize my great group of seniors, and there's been, you know, there's a group of them that are fourth year members. So they've been here, and they've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that senior class, the coolest thing about them that I get to say about them and brag on them is they're all leaving, and they brought a national title to this university, each and every one of them. And I just think that that's something really special. You don't see that a lot, and our future is definitely bright here at WKU.
Nice hardware that they're wearing on their
clothes. Wasn't there a picture where you all were all holding out?
Thank you
guys again for taking the time to listen to us.
Thank you guys. Thank you.
Dr. Bell, that wraps up student affairs.
All right, well, thank you very much. And we have several announcements. Concerning meetings for the rest of the year. They're there for our calendars. And if there is no other business to bring forth, I'll take a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
I have a motion and a second to adjourn. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Like, sign, stand, stand.